Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Adding my thanks to Jamie and also again to Nicholas. Thank you. I've been joined by this expert panel who I'm going to allow them to introduce themselves and then we will go to the results of our poll. So hopefully you've all voted. But first, let's go to some of our guests. Nicholas, don't think we need to introduce you again. So Hugo, perhaps you would go first.
Sure. Hugo Perez. I'm a director of HSBC Innovation Bank, formerly SVB UK. I work on what we call the Global Treasury and Payments Advisory. So really my role is helping you get the most out of us as a bank. You could call me a banker. I've been in banking about 14 years. The last six focused on the MBFI or fintech space. I like to call myself a fintech banker, effectively. I love the sector and yeah, really happy to be here.
Thanks, Hugo. Millie.
Hi, Millie Richardson. I've been in financial services for about 25 years, the last 11 or so in foreign exchange and payments. I'm currently CEO of the Association of Foreign Exchange and Payment Companies, and we support our members meeting the changing regulatory environment.
Thank you, Millie. Phil.
Hi, everyone. I'm Phil Creed. I co-founded and I'm of FSCOM and I'm Director of Financial Crime.
Rick.
Hi, my name is Rick Sierra. I am head of banking at FSCOM. I also responsible for delivering prudential risk management across our firms.
And last but not least, Heather.
Hi, Heather Gorman, Associate Director at FSCOM and also head up the authorisations team here as a payments SME.
Do you want me to give you the results of the poll? Okay, so I'll just remind everyone what the actual question was which of the below themes do you think would be the most topical in your business for the year ahead? And the options were safeguarding, operational resilience, consumer duty, financial resilience, and contingent reimbursement. And just nipping ahead at a late stage with safeguarding with 55%, then on to operational resilience, consumer duty, financial resilience, and contingent reimbursement.
No surprise there, I think, on the safeguarding point and very much in line with your comments, Nicholas. Mm. Anybody want to share any thoughts on the results?
Contingent reimbursement being low is interesting. I think it's going to be a lot of hard work for a lot of firms this year to make sure they get it right.
Thank you.
I think it was probably challenging for a lot of people to just pick one, to be honest.
So I think we would say they're all probably to be top of the list, so it's hard to pick one.
Fair point. Well, now we'll get back to our structured conversation, and I'll remind you what those strategic priorities are. Reducing and preventing serious harm, setting and testing higher standards, and promoting competition and positive change. Now, if you remember, if you cast your mind back to when this plan was produced by the FCA, it was early last year, and it was around the time that Silicon Valley Bank was having its difficulties. And of course, since then, we've had two failures, very sad announcements of firms in the payment sector, one here in the UK, one in Ireland, who are also winding down. So we have a great deal of examples of economic uncertainty. I think everybody will be interested to hear Hugo's reflections of having lived through that situation. So Hugo, please inform us.
Yeah, I won't go into the economics of why Silicon Valley Bank failed. I think those were widely publicized. What I will say, I mean, personally speaking, it really, surreal is the word. When we look at it, we're taking a traditional bank run, which a lot of banks prep for, you know, you've got plans for, you cater for, happening in a technological age to a bank which is solely focused on the innovation economy. So business such as yours and a few other sectors. You can plan all you like, but you know, how do you plan for a bank with, at the time of fail, $289 billion in funds going under in under 12 hours? It's just almost impossible. Personally speaking, I is a real test of character, and it's a bit of a blur. I've got colleagues here who were with me during that failure, and what I will say is, it's going to sound cheesy, but from the note, when we received the notice and we started to see things were going a bit haywire, the focus was really the clients. It was. It was calls out, let's try and get some comfort, get some knowledge out to the market, and actually get some understanding ourselves of what's going on. It's difficult to explain. There was so much emotion going on. What I will say, thank God HSBC came in. I think the rationale for them coming in is really based on the fact that the team in the UK, so SVB UK had been an independent bank since August of 22. So it financially, it was stable, it was strong. It was more in terms of dependence on tech from the US. But when we look back at it, the reason for HSBC coming in was SVB UK was financially a very strong financial institution. The team that I worked with, and you know, from the servicing agents to the CEO, had a plan on how to build a very strong bank that worked in today's environment and was able to serve the types of clients which we love. And you know, having looked at that over that weekend, and there were a number of published suitors for the bank who bid, but to have someone like HSBC come in is monumental. And it was a big move as published size for them, because they've probably traditionally been seen as a more archaic, slow-moving bank. And since then, it's been roll your sleeves up and build something. Personally speaking, you've had 3 years of trying to build a bank and actually build a solution and work with your clients, and it falls over in 24 hours. You know, what do you do? You get behind your CEO, who spent two nights trying to negotiate with the FCA and the suitors and come up with a solution and say, okay, we're here, let's rebuild, let's go. And we're in a much better position than we were, I say. We're actually 10, 20 years ahead of the position before SVB failed. We have a great parent, huge market presence. The way we look at it and the way HSBC Innovation looks at the market is completely different, I say, from a lot of banks. And yeah, we're still here. We're still here. That's what everyone says. We're still here. Thank God. Yes, yeah, so not much in terms of economics, but that's more of a personal.
Melly, as the chairperson of a CEO of a trade association, you are close to firms that will have been very directly impacted by the difficulties with SVB. Perhaps you could share your experience.
Yes, I think if nothing else, the last few years have probably taught all firms to expect the unexpected. We're in a time of real economic change and uncertainty. And I think it's very, very important. I think I was listening to Nicholas actually and starting to feel slightly sick as you went through your list. And then I reminded myself I'm no longer a compliance and risk officer. And I felt an awful lot better. So I really sympathise with firms. They've got stretched resources. There aren't always enough good resources to buy in to support you. You're trying to grow your business, you're excited about your new innovation, and someone comes across and says, you've got to now start sorting out your wind down plan. It's not really what anyone wants to do or invest time in. And I think for me, I always try and look at it that actually a lot of what can cause you to fail can also stop you growing. And really understanding those early warning indicators, that slight slide in liquidity, it's really important if you want to grow as well as preparing for an unexpected scenario and a wind down. I think also having recently been through it, the kind of disciplines you go through for the operational resilience, the wind down planning, are also incredibly useful for the sale of a business and preparing for sale. So there is massive value in these things from a commercial perspective, as well as for the, you know, the very obvious reasons the FCA need and require you to do them.
Thank you. Rick, you and I recently did some work with AFIP, where some members kindly volunteered their wind down plan for our review, and we gave some feedback to them directly. Perhaps you could give some summary of the things that we find.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty long list, but I won't go through everything. The thing that came across initially was the fact that, it was a mix of capital markets firms and payments firms. And what we found was that firms that had been subject to MiFID II, which is the investment firm regime, which some capital markets firms fall under as well, they had the skill sets in-house already, which meant that they could do things like stress testing, forecasting, and they could do wind-down planning as a result. So having that in place was very beneficial to them. And the payment services, less mature of a sector, that they struggled a little bit. I think the main things that came out from it were, to start off with, timelines. So there was a view that most firms could wind up between three to six months, which isn't realistic. I think 12 months is more realistic for most firms, and I think the FCA would agree with that. Group issues. So a lot of firms are part of a group, and there's not, there wasn't enough consideration given to the interconnectedness of firms to their group. So if you're an entity within a group, you're quite often reliant on the group to provide services to your firm, and also potentially funding as well. So if you are going to get into trouble, you might ask for your for the group to provide you with capital liquidity. Not all firms considered what might happen if the group itself was in trouble. So there's an issue there that needs to be considered for a lot of firms. The other thing I noticed was behavioural assumptions. They weren't always considered by a lot of firms. So when you are going through wind down, the view that your suppliers and your creditors have of your firm is fundamentally different. You might find that you're not getting credit where you previously did. You might find that suppliers see that you're in trouble and decide to, well, actually, you know, we're not going to provide you with those services anymore because you probably can't pay. Which can completely scupper your wind down plan. So it's things like that that need to be considered. And then just touching on scenario assumptions. So one thing I found very often with many firms was that they started their wind down, that wind down period from the BAU position rather than a stress position. So if you're in wind down, you've gone through a stress, you've exhausted lots of recovery options. Your firm has depleted lots of resources. It's not in a position where it was in BAU. So it's just worth considering your starting point and making it a little bit more realistic. I think those are the main points. Just one last point was on model detail. It leads to the point that I made at the beginning, which is that skill set isn't always there for payment services firms of having that kind of modeling and scenario testing kind of skill set. So it's worth investing in that, getting some real modeling skills in-house so that you can actually do some more granular modeling, particularly when it comes to cash flow and having that very granular look at modeling in that first week. You want to be daily, and then you can sort of go weekly for the first month, and then for the rest of the period, a wind down period, you can go monthly. But all the liquidity issues happen up front, so really think about that. So yeah, that's really the feedback on wind down planning.
That would certainly reflect the issues that we see in many of the firms. I think the other point around behaviours, and it goes to your point around it will take you more than 12 weeks to wind your firm up. Customers won't behave the way that you expect them to behave. It will be harder to reach a cohort of customers than you expected. You'll need to think about different ways of communicating with them. And then you also have that challenge of there will be customers that you cannot get in touch with, but you are still holding their money. And you still need to find a way to, at some point, return that to them or hold it for a period until they come forth to collect it. And we haven't really seen enough firms putting thought into that side of it as well, and how they're going to fund that element of the wind down.
It does almost become the unanswerable question, though, doesn't it? Will the FCA say that there's a certain point that they can, firms will hold the money for, and then they'll be allowed to?
So I think it is tricky, and we've seen different attempts at solutions as to how to deal with that. But you're also going to end up with a challenge. So that more than two firms have failed or gone through solvent wind downs in the last year for varying different reasons. And obviously some of the customer funds aren't necessarily legitimate, so you're going to have to work out what to do with them and how you're going to approach that. There is no easy solution, I don't think, and that's certainly something that I imagine is on people's mind when they're considering the future regime and how they're considering that.
Which lands us over to talking about safeguarding, Heather?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a massive correlation between the two, the wind down plan and safeguarding ultimately. And I'm probably speaking very much to your speech already, to be fair, Nicholas, but I think what we're seeing a lot of our firms doing is diversifying from a safeguarding perspective. And speaking back to your points, Hugo, about and to yourself, Millie, about the unknown. We don't know what we don't know right at the moment. And I think the only way to be able to de-risk yourself is by diversifying your portfolio of banks or using the insurance method, as you mentioned. Ensuring that you're starting to have those thoughts and processes now. I'm sure most of the people in this room have been through the process of trying to onboard with a bank for a safeguarding account. And we all know that it is not an easy process. Whenever I'm doing an authorization, first thing I say to people is, have you started your conversations with your safeguarding bank? Because chances are it'll take you just as long, if not longer, to get through their process as it would with the FCA authorization. Even now, even as regulated active firms, you can demonstrate that you are acting in a compliant manner and producing safeguarding audits, still expect it to take 12 months to get through an application with a bank. Start thinking about it now. We've been working quite closely with Protean Risk as well as part of the insurance product. Highly recommend anyone who's sort of quite established in the market, anyone who's doing this, as we'd call it, double safeguarding, where you're utilising another third-party payment provider to send your funds. Insurance can be a great option. There are so many different ways to start thinking about how to ensure that you can keep up with your safeguarding requirements, especially, again, given Nicholas's speech today, and that it sounds like there's going to be some additional guidance. I've put here, expect higher standards. I think actually what we should be saying is there will be higher standards. What do you need to do? What do you need to think about? What do you need to operationalize to ensure that you can remain compliant with not only the current standards, but also those enhanced going forward?
I have to admit, I was rather hoping that you would be announcing the safeguarding consultation here tonight. You give us a hint as to when we can? It's long awaited now.
Every time I say when something can get consulted on, it always moves. So this
keep
year.
Keep saying it.
This year.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll draw a line on that one and move to setting and testing higher standards. And we've seen this play out, particularly the government and the payment systems regulators focus on authorised push payments and the reimbursement plans. Phil?
Yeah, well, from a financial crime perspective, I would say this is probably the biggest challenge for firms this year. The thing about APP fraud and the reimbursement model is it actually comes from a really good place, right? I was in a working group with regulators and some law enforcement, and particularly in COVID and a recession, fraud just went through the roof. Heather told me some stats, 40% of all UK crime or something like that. But what law enforcement are saying is, you know, money mules or fraudsters are, you know, setting up with EMIs, maybe getting shut down, opening up with another EMI, you know, down the road for sake of argument, getting shut down, going down, and the data sharing is just not coming across. So because it's a reimbursement model for the sender and the receiver, it's actually putting the obligations on the sender and the receiver. And so the expectation here is that, you know, at onboarding, I think sort of every payments firm or every fintech firm wants to do it faster, better, quicker, right? Like it's always like, let's get them on board and as quickly as possibly we can. Quite a lot of firms aren't using CIFAS or equivalent databases like that. The expectation is that you're going to have to, because what this reimbursement model means is that it's actually going to cost you money. And the fact of it is that the liability goes up to £415,000 split 50-50. So I think there's a lot of work that firms need to do. They need to have a look at their framework overall, particularly sort of, we've seen some really good stuff at onboarding from a number of firms that are very techy and use the fraud engines, IP addresses, all this sort of stuff to do onboarding. But I know from doing it, quite a lot of firms don't do that, and that would probably be the biggest uplift.
It goes beyond the onboarding. It's thinking, you know, continuing to monitor those transactions, identifying where account use has changed from what you expected it to be. But then thinking about, you know, we know that you want payments to be as fast and as smooth as possible. And often many consumers want that as well. that there are going to be times when it's right to start to put more friction into that journey. Think about how and when you can apply that friction. I mentioned in the speech about breaking the spell, you know, recognize it's not easy, but the amount of time and effort that's been put into it today versus where it needs to be, I think that's where we need to see a real shift in the industry.
I think the confirmation of payee piece is really interesting. And I think it plays interesting to your point, Phil, where there is no confirmation of payee between closed loop transactions and an EMI, right? So I think that's an interesting element that you bring into your speech. That's really interesting to hear that's something that you're really going to be focusing on as part of your agenda. I think confirmation of payee is a fascinating piece of new legislation, and to be honest, I was actually surprised when I heard it didn't already exist. I could put Mickey Mouse and someone else's sort coding account number and make a payment. I think to think that that technology didn't even exist until recently it's almost madness, right? It's such an important element. And I think it's really important for everyone in the room to know just how much it's going to be applying to yourselves as well. So I'd imagine most of you in here are in the Group 2 initiative to implement confirmation of payee requirements, 31st of October. Put it in your calendars. Make sure you're all thinking about it early, because it is a highly technical requirement that you are going to really think about from a software point of view. I'm going to pepper in OB Connect. I believe Russell West and Simon Lyons are in the room waving over there. They have been my absolute go-to for anything confirmation of payee. So highly recommend, if you have any questions, either find one of us and we'd be more than happy to help. But I think one of the really interesting things is how to apply it outside of the traditional EMI concept. So a lot of the people in the room might be more payment account providers that don't have a virtual IBAN or a virtual account number they're offering to clients, and how that's going to be building into Pay.UK's requirements, I think is going to be an interesting shift and still a conversation in the market, but really something to start thinking about early, because you need to be signing up with Pay.UK ASAP.
What I will add from the bank side, certainly I think the new regulations and the new outlook, you mentioned it can take 12 months to onboard with a bank. This should help. I mean, banks don't take 12 months for the sake of taking 12 months, you know, they're slow. It's traditionally, let's be honest, I mean, I think banks have held the responsibility for push payment fraud. We could say, you know, the majority of activity happens on outside of the bank, but the banks have borne the brunt of paying, you know, up when it happens. The banks have implemented confirmation of payee, and I'm not trying to defend us, but it's outlining the situation, and gone even further. So a lot of banks, direct clients, look to upskill, be it retail client base or a business or corporate client base, upskill them to try and understand the risks and understand sort of what they're getting into. And that's part of, I think that's part of consumer duty as a financial institution to do that. So when a bank's onboarding a regulated EMI or a payments firm, that fraud piece and the policies and how you look at that and, you know, how you're living that is really taken into consideration. That's what the bank's compliance teams are looking for in sort of in a mature compliance program, in a compliance team who are thinking things through. I always say that the compliance and regulatory section of a regulated business should be a fixed asset. It shouldn't be a fixed cost, not a variable cost. Simply because it needs the funding and it needs the people in there to be able to do this.
And Hugo, what's your take on the sector? Do you feel that that maturity level is getting there? Are you finding those questions that they're being answered, or that the payment and e-money institutions are asking you the right questions?
Sometimes. I mean, let's not lose it. I mean, this whole sector is about breaking the norm. You know, it's what fintech is known for, is why we're all here. We're trying to challenge the standards that have been set by the older banks and what's there. And if you have when I've seen the younger businesses coming through, and it's changed recently, but you know, they don't ask those questions. They don't present that in their product profile on their go to market. They, you know, we're gonna change the world tomorrow. I was like, okay, but have you considered this? No. Okay. What we're seeing now, and I think it probably ties into Nicholas's discussion, and we're starting to see younger firms coming through having that thought out. It's no longer a time where the MLRO, the compliance activity, is done by a CEO or COO or a CFO off the side of the desk, whose primary activity is to try and push a product and break those chains. There's now often a team that's well financed, and it's established. So when we as banks see that, and see that these are being taken seriously, and there are policies and processes that which we can, you've all hopefully on board with a decent bank who's looked to dissect your policies, your processes, how you're living those. When we see that, and we're not having to ask the question, have you thought about this? What about this? It gives us the comfort to push up those timelines and to get you on board earlier. As soon as a bank starts to ask, this is, they see it, this is standard for us as a bank, fraud is standard, we deal with it, we battle it every day in every single way. But as soon as we ask the basic questions, have you considered this? And there is a silence. For us, it's 15 steps back. It's the reputation on that side counts for a lot.
And Millie, with probably the audience being majority compliance people, I think probably most people were relieved, pleased to hear about adding more friction and allowing more time for payments to be made rather than the fast, constant pace. Can we have your reflections?
Yeah, I don't know if they are. I mean, as a compliance officer, you also want to see everything going through the door. I mean, it's a lot easier, smoother, and frictionless. I think for me, the big area that sort of still there's some uncertainty around is where APIs, EMIs are servicing other APIs, EMIs, and offering them virtual accounts. Where does and should the liability sit? I know Pay.UK are still looking at that. I think there's a lot of questions and a short implementation timeframe. But I think for APIs and EMIs who are servicing underlying customers, they really need to start thinking about that downstream risk, how they're going to monitor those underlying clients, what level of monitoring. You look at what the banks do to onboard an API or EMI, I think probably the APIs and EMIs onboarding underlying nested relationships also need to be upping what they're doing to onboard those clients. It may mean there is less availability for those underlying nested relationships to get services as well. So I think that would be my concern. But I think there's a lot of work to do there.
We certainly have an increased focus on, I'm going to put the agent distributor side of things, but that is something that's come across our radar more and more. And the level of maturity in the principal firm, they're understanding that you can't just outsource that responsibility. They have to have this, they're going to have the controls, the oversight, the stronger onboarding. I think that message is starting to land, but there's still a fair amount of way to go, just because of the level of risk that sector and that model raises, that I don't think a lot of firms operating in that space necessarily realise the amount of risk that they're exposing themselves to.
I think it's quite simple to look at. It's from a bank side, when we onboard you, your risks, your gaps, our risks, our gaps. Look at it the same way. You onboard a third-party FI, their gaps, their risks, you're inheriting 100%. From a bank side, we're a further step removed. It gets almost impossible to get our compliance team comfortable with that model because we have no control over it. Then we lose complete control, whether it's the consumer duty, the fraud controls. We just have no sight of what's happening at the other end.
I think the challenge for the sort of banking as a service providers is it's not just, I think if you went back, say, 5 years ago, the focus would have been very much on anti-money laundering. And they would have tried their best to manage that risk, right? It's not just that. It's consumer duty, it's operational resilience. We've now got, the fraud reimbursement model where liability is going to be a wee bit tricky, right? Because some of these firms, they might have their own regulated entity and they might commit the payment themselves, or they might not actually, and they might be doing it almost like on a sort of referral marketing type scenario where actually the principal firm's doing it. But regardless, the principal firm's responsibility is across all those nested relationships, right? So it's whether or not it's outsourced to the agent, in inverted commas, Nick. You need to understand exactly what that agent's doing and what the controls are in that agent, or you need to manage the controls yourself and force the agent to act within your framework. And so it's one or t'other. And it's difficult with those firms whenever you add operational resilience, consumer duty to maybe more immature firms? You know, as Hugo said, maybe the CEO and the MLR is the same person. Those are the sorts of firms in some instances that are operating there. So there's a journey to go, but I think, you know, most of them are aware and certainly trying to work their way along it.
Sorry, what I'll add and what we love from banks agnostically is when we receive a business like yourselves come in and they have a completely segregated compliance team who's agnostic from the commercial side of the business. I mean, if you look at the majority of banks who supported the sector in the UK today, I'll say credible banks who really want to support the sector, they've built in-house teams which are client-facing who are compliance experts themselves. Often they've come from the second line of defense in banks, you know, from building these policies, and are there to support you. When you can face off against them and they can face off against someone who can speak their language, it does wonders.
From what I can see, the division of the lines, there's a lot of talk about dividing the first and second and then even third line in risk frameworks and management, but it's not necessarily well placed in firms, and that's obviously the sign of maturity. Nicholas, you sort of talked about changing the regulatory regime, and we have talked about that a lot, you know, we can see that coming through with safeguarding. I wonder, is there senior managers regime coming through for payments firms soon?
I wouldn't be able to give you a definitive answer one way or another, but I can say that when I do speak to firms, I do often strongly encourage them to consider at the very least undertaking a roles, responsibilities mapping exercise. Even if the whole of SMCR isn't applying to you, be clear in yourself, what are you accountable for? Things will not fall through the gaps that way, otherwise it is passing the buck. So whether or not it's there, I think there is lots that you should and can learn from it and apply it anyway.
I think there's this accountability piece is so important. I think something I've been trying to encourage firms to do recently is having a really robust enterprise-wide risk assessment. You might have 150 odd risks on that assessment. You're going to set someone as responsible for that risk. Who is owning that risk? Do they actually have the expertise and the knowledge to apply the controls to really mitigate that risk? For you to be able to go to bed as a CEO, sleep at night, knowing that that individual has actually mitigated that risk correctly and can tell you which controls to put in place? That's where I tend to start with that mapping exercise, is that whole, what are your risks? Who do you have on your team who can really mitigate them for you?
Thank you. And we've mentioned operational resilience a few times. So I wanted to mention our where we find firms struggling with operational resilience. 2023 was all consumer duty. 2024 is operational resilience. And the focus has to be on the testing now. Self-assessment should be well done. It's the testing and the real severity of the scenarios that are being tested. And as we've mentioned, seeing that flow all the way through to the different providers that you might well be using. Drawing that one to conclusion, let's move on to the third, which is about promoting competition and positive change. So let's reflect on the competitive landscape. And in recent weeks, we have heard about Zing. So Hugo, I wonder if you'd tell us about Zing.
I can. I granted, I wasn't actually involved in the building of Zing. So I'll speak to it from sort of agnostic position in the market and actually what I know of HSBC, and that they're dabbling in a similar model. I mean, it caught the market by surprise. Start of the year, here's great new sort of P2P payments firm. Some took it well, others not so well. I think, I mean, when we look at the rationale for Zing by HSBC, and to be honest, Zing is it's publicized, but it's an independent business within the group, within the HSBC group. It has an e-money license. It's not piggybacking off a banking license. It has an e-money license. So it has a lot of the responsibilities that you have as independent businesses. But obviously, it has a founding team with a lot of experience in banking. HSBC as a bank, and just provide a bit of clarity, has had success, be it in the retail space with Global Money, if you're a HSBC client, which is a similar model for HSBC clients, and actually the corporate and business bank with Global Wallets and Global Disbursement. So they've tested it, they've tried it within their four walls, And then when you look at the market, and I the figure for this year was about £800 billion of flow through international P2P remitters from the UK. There's a big market here. There's a huge, huge market to play for. And obviously that they want to then capture a greater audience, a greater retail retail market. It makes sense for the bank and for the group. It really does. It's, for me, it's refreshing to see. Some will say it's been done in the past and it's failed, but it's refreshing to see actually, again, what could have been considered an old school, dusty bank actually partner with, actually it was publicized as XYB by Moniz, to partner with Moniz and actually come to market with something fresh. When I say fresh, it's, you know, a new type of organization, building on the bank's experience, the knowledge, but leveraging the new tech that's available. Let's see, you know, they have to compete with Wise and Revolut, two very well-established players in the UK market. The market is there to be, you know, to be compatible. Let's see what happens. Yeah, first to the finish line.
It's been like it's a really interesting place. It's really interesting to see HSBC come in. You know, I'm sure everyone's seen Chase and all the adverts that Chase are doing, which is also very interesting. I think in terms of competitive landscape, you know, the more scrutiny at the gateway from the FCA is probably going to change that a wee bit, in that firms that are getting through that are going to be a lot more robust and probably a lot more competitive quicker. So you may see less firms, but you'll see stronger, well put together firms, I think, that are going to come through.
Millie, I think it was fair to say Nicholas mentioned competition and seeing innovation in the market a fair few times. Do you wanted to comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, you're hearing this a lot from the FCA. It's obviously a really important area. At the same time, what I'm hearing from member firms is at grassroots, it doesn't always feel like it. You know, authorizations, it can be, you know, unlike other European countries, you can't have that discussion up front with the FCA before you go for application. You know, I think innovation, it's happening. Rounds, I think it's quite scary on the supervisory level sometimes when you see sort of new innovations come in. I'm not sure it's being managed throughout the FCA in the way that is intended, or there are issues. I mean, I know lots of firms who've had problems with authorizations and delays, and even getting individuals on boards can take a long time. And that does slow firms down. It stops them doing what they want to do as quickly as they want to do it. There may be good reasons behind that, but I do think there is a differential in how firms are feeling and the comments coming from the senior leadership at the FCA.
I think it's worth noting that once a firm is within the perimeter, we obviously launched the early high growth oversight team a little while ago, and that's been going from success to success. So we're trying to get the right firms into the perimeter and give them the right support so they can grow in the right way to benefit the wider competition and consumer landscape. It's going to take time.
And consumer duty was one of the areas that was mentioned quite a lot about how intensive, high expectations. Whilst everybody signed up to having customers at their heart and the forefront, the actual practical development of it is both time consuming. It's requiring a lot of information, a lot of data, that firms are struggling to bring together. We sort of talk in FSCom with clients, and we're, you know, if they haven't already struggled with the data, if they haven't already had plenty of arguments with first line and discussions around what is what represents good customer outcomes, then they probably haven't implemented consumer duty properly yet, and that will be because they're having to do it at the side of their desk. So that is, again, of course, UK FCA looking to be at the forefront of developments there, but it is. There is a cost and a real impact on firms. I think we'll be seeing that a lot this year ahead.
A lot of the challenges we saw with consumer duty, Alison, was actually understanding the firms understanding where to draw the line. Is it when to stop sort of interrogating data? La, 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 la. I think, you know, to be fair, I think that's probably where our role comes in quite strong. It's like, you know, we see across the wide variety of firms of how they're trying to implement consumer duty, and sort of where I think it's like there's no precedent for it, Nick, to be fair, and that kind of needs to settle down before we understand sort of truly how this is going to get implemented properly?
What I would say is, if we come asking questions, please do not recite our own policy statements back to us. It's just a red rag to a bull, right? You need to demonstrate that you've actively considered how the duty applies to your business, your customers, your risks. That is one of the main areas that I think we probably see firms falling down at the moment whenever we do go and speak to them. The ones that have done it right, they've considered it end-to-end in the journey. They can say what are good outcomes. They can say what the harm is. They can say what they're doing to deal with that. They can say how their fraud controls relate to that. They can say all of it. But too many right now just tell us what the duty says and what the outcomes are, what the principles are.
And I think there's a real temptation to say that everything's been looked at and actually it turns out everything's fine. There isn't actually a problem. It's a bit like when you're asked, you know, what are your complaints data telling you? They're telling us there's no complaints. That's probably not the right answer. And I think you've alluded to that in your comments. Heather, do you want to pick up on open banking?
I can briefly speak on open banking, absolutely. Great to hear from yourself as well, Nicholas, talking about what I think could be a really big year in open banking. I think not only with JROC, but also just with, I think there's some really strong players in the market, and I think there's some real good opportunity. I think something that I'll be quite interested to see is if the introduction of COP could potentially see us reducing risk to such a level in a faster payment environment that it's actually become safer for merchants, less chargebacks by using a PISP product than by using a card product. I think that could be a really interesting change. Can we actually reduce fraud at the till by people using a PISP solution rather than a card solution? I think that's going to be a really interesting test case for this year. But ultimately, I think it's, again, coming back to that consumer duty piece, and I think consumers are getting more and more incentivized to use PISP. And the more we can incentivize customers to use it, the more we're going to incentivize merchants to use it, the more we're going to incentivize the market to grow. So I'm really excited for the opportunities this year.
No, I was going to add to your point. I think, I mean, open banking has been around for a few years and everyone's waiting for it to take off. From the banking side, I think some people look to us and go, hey, you're not doing much in around this. You know, there's a regs requirement. Give us your APIs. Launch the APIs. And a lot of banks have sat on their hands, I'll be honest. I feel they've sat on their hands. It's kind of like it's a regulatory requirement. We've done it. There's nothing else there. Being inside of a bank, I feel that a lot of banks are now starting to look at opportunities. You know, it doesn't, not necessarily monetizing these APIs and these functionality, but the advantages they can give to their client base, to your point, in regards to the fraud piece and actually, you know, other just making clients' life simpler. Some of the big players, I mean, some of them are, you know, their whole mission statement is we want to kill cards. Fantastic. Then the banks are seeing this as, okay, let's get ahead of the curve. Whether it's with enhanced APIs, you know, I think it was a couple of months ago, Xero announced a partnership with a firm to actually support settlements directly out of the accounting platform to, you know, to a bank. Whichever bank gets ahead on that and is able to provide the links in, you know, to support those, there's a natural benefit because then the clients are going to flood to that bank. So I think certainly this year and next year, it's really going to take off.
Panelists, thank you. You've done a brilliant job, but the interrogation's not over yet. We're now moving over to the audience questions. And Jamie, what have we got on Slido?
Yeah, thank you, everyone. There's been a whole host of questions. We're never going to have enough time to get through them all, but we will respond after the event and certainly give our view on it and seek some of the consultation from the panel. Maybe just start. There's a lot for the FCA, so FCA ones, and I am moderating some of these, by the way. But we talked about safeguarding, and someone's put a good question in. When looking at the new safeguarding proposals to more closely aligned to CAS, how will the FCA review this against so many different payment operating models?
I think that's where it's key that we hear from the industry. I mean, we've done many consultations now. We do really desperately want to hear from you. That's why we ask the questions. We spend a lot of time putting these papers out. So once the consultation goes live, read it, respond, have conversations, invite us along to events. We want to hear what it means for you in reality, so we can make sure that it does actually do what we want it to do, not just what we think it's going to do.
And another question that's come in, Nick, and then I will move on to someone else. Again, we were talking about wind down plans, and the question has come through: will the FCA be looking to introduce similar to bank recovery and resolution planning for firms?
I think I don't know is the honest answer. There's a lot of work to do in the future, so I think just watch this space.
And a question's come in just around, Nicholas, you referenced obviously the increasing use of insurance as part of the safeguarding regime. And the question's come in: where can firms source that insurance coverage?
So there's still quite a limited number of brokers in the market offering the solution. It's taken quite a long time to work with the FCA to get, I think, the word approval is definitely the wrong word, but to get comfortable with the wording around the insurance product. We've been working quite closely with Protean Risk. I know that we're on the list potentially. I don't know if they're here today, but there are a handful of others. We've seen Travellers potentially offering, and Superscript, I think I've heard on the market as well. It's still a growing space. If anyone is potentially interested in finding out more about how the insurance product works and potentially having a conversation with the brokers who work in that space, I'd be more than happy to facilitate.
What I'll add, sorry, just a bit of insight. What we're seeing coming out of Europe, not seeing out of the UK, especially PSD3, we're starting to see murmurings, is actually LCs being using to a second level of safeguarding. So you will hold a client money, then back it with an LC from a tier one bank for a certain value, which could be sometimes cheaper than insurance policy on the funds.
Another key area that's coming through in the questions is also around APP fraud. And someone has asked the question, why should the sending back be responsible for any reimbursement if they've undertaken every check possible and the fraud is due to the receiving bank?
It's my view is it's to encourage people to have stronger onboarding controls and to stop this where fraudsters are moving from EMI to EMI to EMI. And the only way to probably encourage that behaviour is by it costing the firm money, is the short of it.
Well, sorry, Jamie, what I'll also add, I mean, that's a great point if the fraud is within the UK and under the remit of the FCA. Mm. If we're honest, a lot of the fraud goes internationally and it's outside of the reach of the FCA or even, you know, the sending party. If we look at from a bank side, and I've dealt with it in the past where funds have gone off to the Middle East and then you're suddenly contacting out to the bank and they're saying, hey, we've onboarded and KYC'd the client. We have no proof that they're a fraud. You have to prove that it's actually, you know, true fraud payment. Now, what do? We have an in-country citizen or business who is out of the cash because they've been duped, but it's almost impossible to recover the funds once they've gone overseas. So the responsibility has to lie somewhere. They can't always lie with the individual. We can upskill them, like I said, as part of the, you know, consumer duty. We tell them, try to teach them, try to make sure they don't fall foul to this. But if we are responsible and if we have the bigger pockets and you know, the bigger piggy banks, then it probably falls on us to reimburse those.
I think interesting around that as well is the standardisation of or the enhancement of standardisation around the messaging, especially in SWIFT payments at the moment, where we're going to be sharing a lot more data with each other a lot faster and more efficiently through better messaging, and the way that could potentially reduce fraud. And again, there'll be an element of name checking involved in that SWIFT process in the future too. I think there's a lot of moving parts with fraud, and I think that's why it's really interesting right now. There are so many initiatives going on across so many different bodies, across so many different regions. It's about bringing that all together into a package to ultimately then evidence that all of these elements are reducing fraud as a whole.
And is there much legs in the push for other parties to be in, who are involved in the facilitating fraud in terms of the telephone networks, providers, helping
Facebook Marketplace,
encouraging them to take their share responsibility?
I think we'd hope so. I know there's a paper release, I forget the title, but you know, I think there's a consultation between the social media sites and the FCA around the responsibility. again, being from a bank side, we pay up because we have to pay up, but 99% of the social engineering, say for a basic retail fraud, happens on outside of our control, completely agnostic to it coming to the bank. Very simplistic, I mean, a very simple fraud. An individual comes to us convinced that what they're doing is right, even though we've told them check five times and there's confirmation of payee, but if they do it, they do it. So there needs to be sort of more collaborative and potential, you know, responsibility by the social media sites or the telephone sites on addressing it, essentially.
I saw an interesting figure today, actually. Supposedly 80% of APP fraud initiates from an online interaction. So fraudsters are really moving away from telecommunications. They're just realising that the ability to contact people via social media, instant messaging and email is just so much more effective. And it's just amazing to think that you could be coerced over an email. You know, you haven't even spoken to someone. I think the power of these people is insane, and everything that, and all these initiatives that we can try and bring together to find a solution is so important.
The biggest initiative, I think, or certainly from going to a couple of working groups, what people are really interested in is data sharing. Because all these people, all these fraudsters, they either work out of the same office or whatever it is, right? And it's just trying to stop that hopscotch that I've talked a couple of times is really, really important. And it's getting the data access to not be cost prohibitive to firms that are smaller and maybe more susceptible to this risk but can't afford to get the controls. I think that would go a long way.
It's getting more and more difficult. I mean, from a bank side, I mean, we could spend a whole afternoon talking about AI and everyone's talking about, you know, how AI is going to be amazing and change the world. Yes, but we're seeing the negative side of it today. Whether it's our call centers being bombarded, literally bombarded by the voice, you know, amendments or how they work, or the clients being contacted again by changed voices or AI protocols or built bots. Sometimes it's impossible to tell. And it's just moving so, so fast. We need to try and keep up.
I do know there is a concern from smaller firms that it's the sending bank that is responsible for any investigation. There's a fear that larger banks may decide anything under 20 grand, 50 grand isn't worth investigating. Whereas as a small APR EMR, you may have chosen to investigate it more thoroughly yourselves because you've got the resources and that's a significant amount of money. And I think that's a real fear for some of the smaller players in the market.
There's two more areas I just want to dig in that's coming through in the questions, and then everyone's off the hook, as Alison says. But just keeping on this APP fraud point, there's a good question that's come in, which is, could APP fraud reimbursement, so the reimbursement rules, lead to either PSPs choosing to de-risk by not accepting consumer flows, and or B, exit the market due to obviously suffering large fraud losses? I suppose it's I'll maybe start with you, Millie, because obviously as CEO of AFIP, this is obviously a topical issue. And then any other thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of firms are talking very, very seriously about which customers they'll keep. In some cases, with good reason, maybe they are looking more closely at the underlying nested relationships they have. So sometimes it's a good thing, but there are areas where they won't service. If you look at their capital models, they're now going to have to look at capital and liquidity to fund any of these losses. And even with really strong controls in place, there may be an expensive fraud that goes through. It may mean they need to exit or sell. I mean, it's very difficult. I think a lot of firms are looking at the sectors they will serve. You will see some people squeezed out. But I think it's a product of the amount of fraud that the regulators are seeing.
I think there's I think going back to all of these initiatives that are in place, it's not like it's the sudden, oh, now you're going to be liable. Good luck. You know, there's a lot of initiatives around trying to help firms to improve their fraud controls from a prevention and detection point of view. So I think the whole point of the reimbursement scheme is it's the backup, right? It shouldn't be what everyone is panicking. Well, they should be worrying, obviously, about making sure they can afford it, etc. Building it into wind down plans. But realistically, it's about building the controls to prevent you having to worry about the reimbursement scheme in the first place. We want to stop the fraud before it gets to the reimbursement issue. So really working, as we say, from a data sharing point of view, building in your COP capabilities, making sure that your onboarding and ongoing reviews from a fraud perspective are as keenly sharp as possible in data sharing where we can.
I think that's right to an extent, but I think it is also almost impossible to stop any fraud. And if you've got a capital requirement of €20,000 and suddenly you've got a bill for €200,000, there's a big issue for you. So yes, you're right. Everyone needs to build stronger controls. All the firms I know are looking at it, but it's unrealistic to think you're going to stop fraud.
I was going to say, I don't want to sound like the Grinch, but I guarantee you every firm will have to pay out some form of this fraud. Sorry, Elaine.
And just moving on to the very last question, and thank you all for fielding them. There's a lot of good discussion today and this evening around innovation. And clearly, the payment space should innovate, and we want to see it innovate. But with an increasing list of requirements, the question said, can those two coexist? Can you innovate plus meet the enhanced requirements and costs? Open question.
Need to innovate to cut costs, don't we? That's the... But yeah, and we've seen some firms with some really excellent ways of using AI and technology to reduce costs, and you know, watch the space for more coming.
What I would say, I mean, we've gone through 2 years, and Nicholas mentioned it. Investor liquidity into this space dropped off a cliff between 22 and 23. I think from early stage to later stage, it dropped by about an average of 65%. From the banking side, and actually being involved specifically, you know, with VC and investor-backed businesses in this space, we're starting to see green shoots. Effectively, we're starting to see Series A's coming through at good amounts, Series B's at even greater amounts. So, when you're looking at the costs of, you know, compliance and you know, it's what we're involved in, have some comfort that, you know, a lot of businesses would have turned the last year to cost cutting, to slimming down. There may be cash on the way.
Well, that sounds like a very positive note to finish on.
I hope so.
Can I just thank you all. It's been a superb panel. I hope everyone's got the insight and the benefit. Thank you. I suppose just very briefly in closing, I mean, there's a couple of themes. Innovation, clearly we've talked about extensively, and I think that is very, very important as an industry. And we should continue to want to innovate as well. But with innovation also comes an element of interconnectedness, which enhances the need to make sure that the firms are connected, operational resilience is strong. And overwhelmingly, we've talked a lot last year, and we continue to talk a lot about consumers and making sure that there are good consumer outcomes. And I think that doesn't just come through your thought process and your procedures around consumer duty. Good consumer outcomes come through things like safeguarding and making sure that not only can you return funds, but you can do so in a timely fashion. And then it goes through into wind down planning. And one thing I would say from our experiences of working with clients, they make a lot of effort to get the approach right. But also you'll need to think about it from the consumer perspective rather than the firm. If you're drafting your wind down plan, what would be good for the consumer rather than what works for us as a business as well. Just very finally to thank everyone this evening. So thank you to our experts on the panel for all of their insight. Events like this are never seamless. And a big thank you to Elaine and our marketing team in FSCOM. They've done a fantastic event and to get it set up this evening. They have got a number of events that they're running over the next 2 weeks. So thank you to Elaine and her team. Very final thanks is to everyone for turning up this evening. And this is probably our first one, but won't be our last event. So I look forward to seeing everyone throughout the course of the year. Thank you.